And welcome to the Deep Dive Radio Show. As always, I'm your host, Nick Espinoza, and we're going to be talking about all things cybersecurity, cyber warfare, and technology related. And I think we're one of the only ones out there that's doing that right now. If you'd like to be part of the radio show in any way, shape, or form, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Nick AESP. Again, that's Nick AESP. Or you can send us an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. We have an action-packed show as always. There's always a lot to cover, so stick around with us as we deep dive into a topic and we catch up on everything else. So without further ado, let's begin.
And we've got a great show for you this week. Obviously, still recording from my home studio, still social distancing, but this is going to be an amazing, amazing show because I have interviewed Keith Doomling. Now, you may not know him, but he is the Director of Cybersecurity for Technology Protection at the Cleveland Clinic. That's right, one of the greatest hospital systems in the world. And I've got their Director of Cybersecurity in an interview talking about what everybody else isn't talking about. And that's how the hospitals are holding up under the onslaught of cyber threat as they are trying to deal with the massive pandemic that is going on. You do not want to miss this interview. And as always, we're going to start with the news. So let's do it. And in Amazon news, CEO Jeff Bezos has basically been called to testify before the House antitrust panel. Now, here's what's going on. House lawmakers are leading an antitrust investigation into Amazon, demanded a week ago Friday or so, so roughly a week or two from when you're listening to this, that Jeff Bezos, founder and CEO of Amazon, testify about the company's alleged practice of gleaning financial information from third-party resellers to bolster its own private label business. The House Judiciary Committee threatened to subpoena Bezos if he does not voluntarily agree to testify. By virtue of this, Amazon stock actually fell after this announcement. Now, the letter comes after a Wall Street Journal investigation found that Amazon employees in the company's private label business, which I believe is Amazon Basics, and I think there's another one or two of them, had routinely used data from third-party sellers to inform its own product strategy, which is a practice that the company has consistently denied to Congress. That has to be a big complaint from their sellers' platforms, because this is what Amazon has been doing, and that's a very serious issue. And if we're looking at this, Amazon sees their success and then basically rips off these sellers and sells the same thing for way cheaper. So if I'm making some kind of product or tchotchke or whatever, and it's selling like gangbusters, Amazon has access, if I'm selling it on Amazon's website, to how many units I'm selling, how much money I'm making, etc., and says, oh, well, we can produce this tchotchke for half this price, sell it for 30% less than Nick can here, and we're going to make a whole bunch of money, which basically puts me out of business, because why is everybody going to buy my tchotchke when you can go get the exact same thing from Amazon for a whole lot cheaper? That is what they are accused of doing. That is what they have consistently denied to Congress. And that is what Bezos has to answer for in front of the U.S. House of Representatives. So we are going to see where this goes. But this might be the antitrust straw that breaks the camel's back here. So we'll see where this goes. But that is your Amazon news of the week. And in Amazon news, again, because apparently we always have Amazon news here, Amazon has bought cameras to take temperatures of workers during the coronavirus pandemic. Now, I think that makes a lot of sense. Amazon warehouses are some of the most important and critical supply chain sectors at the moment during this pandemic, because they are so unbelievably huge that they supply a lot of the general population with pretty much anything that we need. But here's the thing. They bought these cameras that take these temperatures from a firm the United States has blacklisted over allegations that it helped the Chinese government detain and monitor the Uyghurs, which is a Muslim minority in the country, as well as other Muslim minorities. And this is according to three people familiar with the situation talking to Reuters. Now, the company in question is China's Zhejiang Dahua Technology, and they shipped 1,500 cameras to Amazon in the past couple of weeks in a deal that was worth about $10 million. At least 500 of these camera systems from Dahua, the blacklisted firm, are for Amazon's use in the United States. The Amazon procurement which was not actually previously reported, is technically legal because the rules that control U.S. government contract awards and exports to blacklisted firms doesn't actually stop the sale to the private sector. Amazon being a private company, non-government, are technically allowed to do this. However, the United States, and I quote, considers that transactions of any nature with listed entities carries a red flag and recommends that U.S. companies proceed with caution. This is according to the Bureau of Industry and Securities website. Dahua has disputed this designation, and Beijing has denied the mistreatment of the Uyghurs. And I've actually done pieces I know here on the radio, as well as on my daily video and podcasts, on the just massive surveillance system that the Uyghurs are under right now, thanks to the Chinese government. Not to mention the Chinese government's massive surveillance system over their general population, but Dahua is right in the middle of this. On top of this, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration warned of a shortage of temperature reading devices and said that it wouldn't halt certain pandemic uses of thermal cameras that lack the agency's regulatory approval. So basically, another government agency is turning a blind eye to the sale of blacklist of temperature taking anything from blacklisted companies in the U.S. government. Now, Amazon declined to confirm this purchase from Dahua, but said that its hardware complied with national, state, and local law, and its temperature checks were too, and I quote, support the health and safety of our employees who continue to provide a critical service in our community. Now, I have no doubt that that's what those cameras are, in the sense that they are taking the temperature and making sure that those critical workers are absolutely healthy because they are servicing our communities. Again, Amazon is a master of distribution, supply chain for the United States. But the optics of this don't look good, not to mention the fact if there is some kind of technology that is backdoored into these, could we possibly have a Chinese firm remoting into these cameras or getting telemetry or information from these cameras that might give them insight into how Amazon operates or worse? This is why we don't use blacklisted technologies, because they have the potential for malfeasance that we might not necessarily be able to detect. Now, Amazon, I know, is the largest hosting provider on the planet, with Amazon Web Services, or AWS. Everybody is basically platformed on them, including Netflix, one of their biggest competitors in that space. So I don't think their warehouses have direct access to Amazon Web Services, but nevertheless, this is something that they don't want to do, even if they've got good detection technologies in place. So that is, once again, more Amazon news of the week, and hopefully they'll reverse this decision. And in electricity news, and I think this is actually probably one of the most fascinating news articles I've read in the last couple of weeks, we are literally going to be talking about an article from Bloomberg called Secrets of Lockdown Lifestyle Laid Bare in Electricity Data. And I found this absolutely fascinating. Apparently, life in lockdown means getting up late, staying up till midnight, and slacking off in the afternoon. That is what the power market data is showing in Europe and places where restrictions on activity have led to a widespread shift in daily routines for hundreds of millions of people. And it's pretty much a similar story wherever there's a lockdown, including here in the United States. So, for example, in New York, electricity use has fallen as much as 18% from its normal use at 8 a.m. Tokyo and three nearby prefectures had a 5% drop in power during the weekday after Japan declared their state of emergency on April 7th, and this is according to Tesla Asia Pacific, which is an energy forecaster in the region. So, what does this tell us? This tells us a couple of different things. People are sleeping later. Obviously, with no commute to the office, people can sleep longer. Normally, electricity demand begins to pick up between 6 to 8 a.m., and now, for example, in Germany, it's clear that it's really picking up between 8 and 9 a.m. It's also showing us that we're less productive in the afternoons. There is a deeper dip in electricity use in the afternoon. So previously, power use rose between 2 to 5 p.m. Now, it's dipping as people basically head out for a walk or to get some air during this time period. And so, for example, a chart from the UK grid shows that the afternoon is dropping off across the United Kingdom. We're also spending our evenings in. From 6 p.m., electricity use is beginning to rise steeply as people finish work and start their chores. Restrictions like work from home and schooling that prevent much of the daytime TV watching basically lifts in the early evening, and so these are ramping up. And as we are not going out, let's say, to use the electricity at a restaurant, we are using the electricity at home. We're also staying up late. We're going to bed later too. Demand apparently doesn't drop off until 10 to 12 a.m., which is at least 1 hour later than before here in the United States. We also are realizing that different sectors of the economy are also consuming more electricity. So eating habits have changed, for example. Restaurants are expanding their delivery and offering grocery services as a change from that from having people in, because now we have to dine at home. That's persistent right now in areas that are locked down. So restaurants are consuming much less power than normal, while manufacturers have been retooling to create critical supplies, and they're running around the clock consuming power like nobody's business. And so I thought that was just absolutely fascinating, because I think this really shows, you know, here we are. We have got a massive power consumption, going on. And by virtue of that, because we're in lockdown, because we can't go out, we are consuming that electricity to entertain us strategically. We are sleeping in later and we're taking afternoons off or just chilling. I find myself personally more productive in the afternoon, so I'm usually strapped at my desk. I'd rather go for a walk, if you will, in the morning than I would in the afternoon. And I am not a morning person by any stretch of the imagination. For those of you that know me personally, I think you know this, but it's just, the way of the world right now. I also, and on a complete aside, was in a meeting a couple of weeks ago where there were four or five of us in a video conference, and it actually took us 30 seconds to a minute or so to determine if it was actually Tuesday or Wednesday. And so we are living kind of in a different world, and it's starting to become a little normal, I think, for most of us. And I think our electricity consumption will continue to show this trend until this lockdown is lifted, if you're in a lockdown. And I think most of you listening are in some kind of restrictive mode right now. So with that, that is your interesting electricity news of the week.
You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM.
And in net neutrality news, and we need to talk about net neutrality because there has been some major news that recently came out that could show that the FCC, or Federal Communications Commission, may have been fabricating evidence to bolster support for its decision to kill net neutrality. Obviously, this is a move that is loved by internet service providers and overwhelmingly decried by the general public, as shown in poll after poll on this subject going back for the last few years. Now, here's what's going on. Recently, a federal judge ordered the FCC to turn over server records to New York Times reporters that would reveal the IP addresses behind potentially bogus comments supporting the net neutrality repeal. The New York Times reporters filed a Freedom of Information request for the data after the FCC refused to show its logs. Now, the FCC has contended that divulging the IP address divulging the IP addresses would represent an unwarranted invasion of personal privacy. But Judge Lorna Schofield said that the agency didn't really explain how anyone would be hurt by transferring the data. The judge argued that the benefits clearly outweighed the drawbacks, as fake comments threaten the very nature of the public input system. And to quote Federal Judge Schofield, the notice and comment process has failed if there are more fraudulent comments than real ones. Now, in theory, the logs will show both the extent of fake commenting and help trace it back to groups that may have been involved. Investigations previously by Pew Research and others have suggested that over half of the comments are fake, and some of the comments appear linked to dark money groups determined to skew the political discussion. And I think this is something that is super, super important, because we need to have a very public and a very honest notice and comment process for things like this. The FCC came out a few years ago, once President Trump was elected. This is under his administration, and they appointed Ajit Pai to the head of the FCC and said, we are going to repeal net neutrality. Now, polling has been done over and over, as I mentioned, of the general public that is overwhelmingly not in favor of repealing this. And so when the FCC opened up their notice and comment process, basically, we saw two different floods. a lot of people basically flocked to the banner of pro-net neutrality, saying, please don't kill it, please keep it. And this was pushed by a lot of pundits around there. Most notably was John Oliver of HBO's Last Week Tonight fame. And he got his followers, or rather his viewers, to go and basically flood the FCC comment section to the point where it actually overwhelmed the server. But on the flip side, there has been a lot of comments that have said, no, please kill net neutrality. And those are being tagged as possibly bogus. And the IP addresses should show us if that, let's say there's one group that is just constantly posting multiple comments as, let's say, quote unquote, unique individuals to skew the results towards killing net neutrality. Now, the FCC may or may not be involved in this. This could be political, political groups that are in support of the Trump administration and the killing of net neutrality, but it all ties back to the FCC. They are not being transparent. And if this is a government for the people, by the people, and of the people, you would imagine that they would do this, especially if they can't show how divulging an IP address would be an unwarranted invasion of personal privacy. This is what a federal judge has ruled. And so we're going to see what goes on here, but this is huge, huge news for this, and hopefully we're going to see what exactly is going on. And if it is found that overwhelmingly the comments are bogus on net neutrality, then obviously public opinion skews the other way to keep net neutrality, and we'll see how the FCC responds to that. So that is your net neutrality update of the week. And in wearable technology news, and this definitely relates to the coronavirus, as I'm sure a ton of news does, smart glasses will soon let you see people's temperatures to basically help you from catching the coronavirus. Now, here's what's going on. A Chinese startup, Rokid, that develops augmented reality products for use in manufacturing and gaming, has found a promising growth area in the midst of a global pandemic: wearable glasses that measure temperatures on the move. Now, Rokid Vice President Xiang Wenji says demands have risen for the company's T1 glasses, developed in only 2 weeks after it sold roughly 1,000 pairs to governments and industrial parks and schools. And to quote Xiang, apart from fixed temperature measurement, T1 can provide portable, distant, and prompt temperature checking, which would be a great help. Now, equipped with an infrared sensor and a camera, the glasses would allow the wearer to see people's temperatures. Now, here's the thing. If you are wearing these glasses and you are walking around in public, and let's say you're walking down the street and you see somebody and the thermal sensors in these glasses read the temperature of the person that you are coming in contact with and says, okay, they've got a temperature of 100 degrees Fahrenheit. This is supposed to say, okay, great, this is going to be social distancing. Now, I'm going to avoid that 100 degree person, maybe move to the other side of the road, on the other, whatever you've got to do. But could this be the resurgence, though, that wearable tech actually needs? If you recall, wearable tech outside of smartwatches has really kind of floundered over the last couple of years. Google created Google Glass, which basically you would wear as an attachment to your glasses or on your face, and that was kind of a mess for them. It really didn't sell well, except for very specific industrial purposes, but the general public didn't adopt it. And this might actually be the shot in the arm that wearable tech needs, and that is the coronavirus. Because now many people might be inclined to be like, oh, it's bulky and it's hideous and it's ugly, but it's going to keep me safe and it's not going to get me sick. Yeah, I'm going to go get those glasses. And then that opens up a whole bunch of other issues in terms of privacy as well, because we've seen other companies start tagging facial recognition systems into this, like Clearview AI. And also, could we potentially create a stigma for those that, let's say, are registering as a temperature? So if everybody is wearing these glasses around me, for example, and I've got a temperature of 100, maybe that's going to be a red flag for people who think I have the coronavirus, when maybe I just have the regular flu. Maybe I run hot. Not everybody is 98.6 degrees. And I think I've mentioned this on the radio before, or maybe it was in one of my videos, but there is basically a trend downwards from 98.6 being the standard, because we've had a couple generations of living indoors with air conditioning, and so people tend to run colder than what they actually are. I know for myself personally, if I'm taking my temperature, 98.6 for me is hot. I'm not saying I've got a fever, but I definitely register lower than that on most thermometers when I am taking my temperature. And so if I'm, let's say, at 98.6 or 99 and people are like, oh, it's no big deal, maybe that means I have a fever. So I'm curious to know how this is going to balance out. But smart glasses may get a resurgence because people are trying to keep themselves healthy. And I think it's something that we need to watch out for. I think that's pretty fascinating. And here we are. And a quick COVID-19 Cyber Threat Coalition update. As you guys know, I'm one of the spokespeople for this wonderful organization, and we are up to almost 4,000 volunteers that are actively going through all of this threat intelligence to create actionable data for hospitals and other critical infrastructure that can go ahead and ingest this information, help defend themselves better. And this has been going on, basically for about a month and a half, and it's been a really cool thing to see. And we keep growing, and I just wanted to give you guys an update that we continue to grow and expand our presence, and we are continuing to give out actionable information to law enforcement that is basically making a real impact and a difference. And if you want to check it out, just real quick, you can go to cyberthreatcoalition.org and take a look for yourself with our threat advisories. It's good information, and hopefully everybody will check it out. And so that is your quick CCTC news of the week.
And now for breaches of the week. And if you have a data breach to report that's local to you or the major news might have missed it, please, by all means, send it to me, and I'm glad to give you a shout out and include it in the radio show and possibly a daily video. And you can find me on Twitter and Facebook at Nick AESP. Again, that's Nick AESP. Or you can email questions at securityfanatics.com. Again, that's questions at securityfanatics.com. And I'm more than happy to include your data breach and give you a shout out on the air. With that, let's begin.
And this week's Breaches of the Week is basically going to be kind of a rehash of the basically the craziest breaches of the last couple of weeks. As you know, my last radio show was about 3 weeks or so because of the weird break between April and May and how this lays out. I usually do it bi-weekly, and I just got an extra week off, if you will. But here we are. And so I'm going to give you the highlights because, quite frankly, if I did every breach for the last 3 weeks, we would spend the entire hour on the radio just talking about those systems that were breached. And we've obviously got a lot of things that we need to cover, from news to deep dive and all of that. So with that, we are going to do the highlights here. And before I begin, I'd like to thank Jason Dance, Tariq Khatib, David Walker, Barrett Peterson, and Chris Fallon for sending me basically information, sending me messages, tagging me in data breaches on various social media platforms. It's always a huge help. And if you have a data breach for me, as I mentioned in the preamble, please send it to me. And with that, let's start with Nintendo. Yes, the massive Japanese video game company has over 160,000 accounts that have been hacked due to attackers abusing a legacy login system. Now, here's what's going on. Over the past month or so, Nintendo gamers have been reporting suspicious activities on their accounts. According to complaints aired out on Twitter and Reddit, unauthorized actors were logging into victims' accounts and abusing payment cards connected to the accounts to buy digital goods on Nintendo's online stores, such as V-Bucks, which apparently is the in-game currency used in Fortnite. Now, in a statement about a week and a half ago, Nintendo said that attackers have been abusing its NNID, which stands for Nintendo Network ID, legacy login system since the beginning of April to hack into these accounts. Now, NNID was primarily used for the Nintendo 3DS handheld, as well as the Wii U console, both of which have now been discontinued. And this is different from a Nintendo account, which is more modern, which is used for the Nintendo Switch, which is basically Nintendo's current console out there. An NNID can be linked to a Nintendo account and then used as a login option. If the attackers were able to gain access to a linked NNID, then they could access the linked Nintendo account, and from there, they'd have access to various payment methods, such as credit cards, PayPal, all that kind of stuff, and are able to make in-game purchases. And so if you have a Nintendo account, you might want to change that password or de-link or get rid of that NNID. Moving on, we're going to be talking about the Sheffield City Council in the United Kingdom. They have an automatic plate recognition system on their roads that is now exposing 8.6 million records of vehicle movements and journeys of their citizens. Now, Accessing the internal dashboard to this database apparently was very easy. No authentication methods or credentials were required, and anyone could have viewed or browsed the live system with a simple copy and paste of the IP address that it was linked to. A representative from Sheffield City's Council and South Yorkshire Police told the Register, and I quote, "We take joint responsibility for working to address this data breach. It is not an acceptable thing to have occurred. However, it is important to be very clear that, to the best of our knowledge, nobody came to any harm or suffered any detrimental effects as a result of this breach." And quite frankly, that is the most British way to say that they couldn't find any abuse of the data. And they always say that in data breaches. Every data breach says that because it's not oftentimes readily apparent that the data breach has actually affected anybody. That can happen weeks or months afterwards, or they just simply didn't find, let's say, all of those identities being sold on the dark web or something. So we'll see where that goes. But there you go. Next up is the Small Business Administration of the U.S. government, or SBA. Almost 8,000 business owners who applied for a loan from the Small Business Administration may have had their personal information exposed to other applicants, and the SBA admitted this a couple of weeks ago. Now, this breach relates to a longstanding SBA program called Economic Injury Disaster Loans, or EIDL. It has traditionally been used to aid owners whose businesses are disrupted by hurricanes, tornadoes, or other disasters. It was recently expanded by Congress in the $2.2 trillion CARES Act. This is due to the coronavirus. In addition to the loans, the law authorized grants of up to $10,000 that don't need to be paid back by the business. Now, the EIDL program is separate from the larger Paycheck Protection Program that was also part of the CARES Act. The SBA says that the Payment Protection Program, those applicants were not affected by this breach. It's only the small business loans. And this is according to a Trump administration official, and I quote, "The official said that in order to access other business owners' information, small business applicants must have been in the loan application portal. If the user attempted to hit the page's back button, he or she may have seen information that belonged to another business owner, not their own. The SBA says it discovered this flaw on March 25th and notified the affected users."
And stay tuned to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show as we take a quick break for a public service announcement. We'll be back right after that.